They say plants like music.
Yeah, no, like really, they respond to the vibrations of it, which means that this playlist you're listening to, the plants are too. You know what else plants like? Organic soil from Miracle-Gro. It's made with all the best stuff like wood fiber and compost. Plus, it's OMRI certified organic, which officially means it's made with superior ingredients. And when you give your plants the stuff that makes them happy, they won't judge you on your iffy playlist.
Hear that, plants?
So go ahead and give them Miracle-Gro.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. On an unseasonably warm winter evening in Pennsylvania, 15-year-old Patty Desmond sneaked out through the basement of her house. She had a history of running away, and that, combined with an argument with her mother, gave police reason to suspect she'd come home in a week or two. The year was 1965. That night was the last time her family ever saw her. Conrad Eugene Miller was well known to local law enforcement. An older married man with a child, Miller's association with Patty was questionable at best. Yet he was the last person known to have seen her alive, and the suspect, police continued to circle back toward. After nothing but false sightings and rumors, the case was moved to the back burner, where it stayed. As decades crept by, reality sunk in. Patty Desmond was never coming back. Then, a tiny crack unleashed a flood of information. And the mystery that had never quite been forgotten was solved. The book that we're featuring this evening is Last Child Seen, The Search for Patty Desmond, with my special guest, journalist and author, Maureen Boyle. Welcome back to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, Maureen Boyle.
Oh, Dan, thank you very much for having me on. I really appreciate it. It's always fun to be on your show.
Thank you so much. Now, let's talk about the Desmond family, Anna Desmond and her husband, and Patty and her five other siblings in Renfrew, Pennsylvania, you say about 30 miles from Pittsburgh. Tell us a little bit more about the family and how it came to be that Anna was a single mother.
It's really quite tragic for the family. Anna's husband died when he hit his head on a block of cement in a tussle, and he died en route to the hospital. That left Anna a single mother of six children in the 1960s. And this was a time when there weren't a lot of jobs for women, you know, well-paying jobs for women. But she would work very hard in anything that was available to put some food on the table and pay the rent for the children. It was a very difficult time for the family. Clearly, Patty's older brothers had gone into the service. And at the time of Patty's disappearance, it was just her and her younger brother who was at home. Patty was a very shy girl. People described her as sometimes being bullied when she was in school. She was a bit quiet. She was the type of girl that people felt sorry for. But they also described her as a very lovely girl.
You talk about December 5th, 1965, and you talk about the last night that Anna ever saw her daughter. What was that night spent doing between the two?
Patty's mother strongly disapproved of a young man who Patty had been seeing. The man was 19, Patty was just 15. He was married and he had an infant child. She felt that this individual, Conrad Miller, was too old for her high school daughter. Patty was just a sophomore in high school. And he had a reputation in the community and not a very good reputation. And she really wanted, one, her daughter to stay as far away as possible from this married man. And Patty was having an argument with her daughter, with her mother. And Patty, later that evening, snuck out of the house. Patty slipped out of the house. She hopped in the car with Conrad and his three friends who were there. One of them was an individual by the name of Stormy Miller, who is a distant relative of Conrad's. And she got in the car with him. Miller dropped off his friends at one of their homes, and they were going to hook up later on. And he took Patty else to a coal mine where they were going to, quote unquote, talk. This was an area well known by young people in the area where people would go drinking or neck. And that was the last time anyone other than Conrad Miller had seen her. Later, Conrad had made some statements to a number of people about what happened next.
Now, two people from Butler Township Police question him and ask him about details about saying that he was the last person to see her. And he gave details about who he was with that night, which was Charlie Ladick and Larry Haskins, and like you had mentioned, his cousin Stormy Miller. What were the statements by those three individuals that were with Miller as to what happened that night?
The three of them, again, had said that they picked up Patty. Conrad had dropped them off to their vehicle, and they were going to meet up with them later. They never did meet up with Conrad. And afterwards, Conrad had said that he told them that he had dropped Patty off at a fire hall, and Patty was in another community, and Patty was going to go to the home of a friend of hers. At another time, he sort of expanded on the story, but no one quite took him seriously because he had been drinking when he would tell different stories, and they didn't think that some of the suggestions that he had made about something happening to Patty were true. They thought that was an exaggeration.
Regarding Mary Rice, you write that Conrad Miller knew Mary Rice because they were neighbors at one time when they were children. And so the way that Patty met Mary was that Miller would bring Patty over to Mary Rice's home. And she said that typically that she would be plied with alcohol when he did bring her over to Mary Rice's. The idea that she would have stayed at Mary Rice's, that she wanted to stay at Mary Rice's, Mary Rice said she never came over. But it was also very interesting, you write that Patty had only stayed at Mary Rice's home one time for a sleepover.
Yes, that was, Mary Rice was supposedly the house that Patty was going to be going to the night that she disappeared. Sometimes Conrad would take her over to Mary's house, because keep in mind, this is a very small community where everyone knows everyone. So he, in the past, had taken her over to Mary's house. Mary had a sister that was about Patty's age. Police went to Mary Rice's house after Patty was reported missing, and Mary told them Patty never showed up at her house. She wasn't expecting her. And after police came to talk with her, Conrad had come to her house and said, I dropped Patty off down the road and she was coming to your house. And Mary said, nope, she didn't come here. And that was the last time she said Conrad ever discussed Patty with her.
Now, this case is frustrating for police because they have no body. They have no evidence that there has actually anything happened to Patty Desmond, but of course they are very, very suspicious, but they can't do much. But what they hear, the rumors that they do hear, is that he likely buried her in one of these strip mines, these abandoned coal strip mines that are everywhere in the area. Now, we have to fast forward ahead to 2 years later, And the parole officer, Conrad Miller's parole officer, is a man named Jack Wagner. And he happens to be at the Butler State Police Barracks. And he's talking to a trooper named Richard Balish about the disappearance, because he had spoken to Patty's sister, Veronica. Tell us about this conversation and what Jack Wagner and this trooper want Conrad Miller to do.
And initially, as you said, Patty's sister had approached the parole officer saying, you know, it's been 3 years since my sister went missing. You know, what's going on? Where is she? And he went to the state police barracks and talked to people there saying, you know, the family's still wondering, you know, what's the story? So they did bring Conrad in. And because he was on parole, they were able to bring him in because his parole officer requested it. And they interviewed him. Initially, it was a standard, just straight interview where he stuck to the story that he had picked Patty up at her house, that they went to the strip mine, that he dropped her off at a fire hall, and that Patty was supposed to be going to her friend's house, Mary Rice. Mary, of course, knew Patty because her sister was also the same age. Conrad used to bring Patty to Mary Rice's house. Mary's sister said that Mary didn't like him bringing the teenage girl over. He would give her alcohol and try to make her do things, you know, act stupid, for lack of a better word. So they were familiar with Patty. So when they state police know what's going on there, they've already spoken to Mary Rice. So when they bring him in and he's telling the same story that he told before when Patty first went missing, and clearly they don't believe him, but they have to figure out ways to get him to keep talking. So they're sort of joking around with him, trying to get his guard down, telling him, well, you know, we don't want to get, quote unquote, get you on having any type of sexual relations with a underage girl. We're just trying to find out where she is and what happened to her. But he stuck to his story that he did not know where she was, that he dropped her off there. He did finally agree to a polygraph test, and the findings of that was inconclusive. They said based on his mental capacity, they could not prove or disprove his story based on the polygraph.
It's very interesting how he talks about the victim. It's actually deplorable, but they get him to talk, as you say, and he says, you know, she wasn't a very good looking girl, so we were going to play a trick on my friend. And then, as you say, the trooper did a brilliant job, Lesh, I believe, in saying that, listen, we don't care about that fooling around, really disarmed Miller into admitting that, yeah, I did mess around with her. You're right. But, you know, we were going to play a trick, but she was there. I was left alone with her. And then we were messing around. And then he asked a really salient question, though. He said, did she say that she was pregnant? Did she say she was going to frame you? Did she say she was going to do something? And then the story of she said she was pregnant to him, that she had told him that she was pregnant, that she was with some guy she wanted to get married. But he was so afraid because he had been accused before, he said. So he was just going to drive her right home. It's very telling how he talks about this victim and sort of can't help partially the truth creeping out in his very conversation with these troopers.
That's a very good point there. His wife was 16, by the way, and he had fathered another child that was about the same age as his child with his wife. And he makes reference to that child in the interview, saying he was, you know, kind of tricked into paying child support and that it wasn't his child. And he claimed in the interview with the police that Patty told him that she was pregnant, and he insisted it was not his. But he said that she had a boyfriend and she was going to run away with him. And that was it. That was one way of probably in his mind of steering police away from him. After that, he claimed that he dropped her off. Initially, he had also told the police that he was going to, quote unquote, fix her up with some of his friends for sex. And that was something that she had absolutely no idea if that it was his intention. She had no idea of any of that. And clearly, she thought that he was her boyfriend, for lack of a better word.
You write that investigators spoke to the three people that were there, but they spoke specifically to Charlie Ladek. And he relayed some fascinating, again, you call it circumstantial evidence, but evidence where he said that a year after this in 1966, that Miller had threatened him in a bar. He had this bizarre dream that his wife was fooling around with Ladek, that Miller's wife was fooling around with Ladek, and he saw it in a dream and then confronted him and said, "Kill you just like I killed that girl." So that statement was with the investigators. Then they spoke to Larry Haskins, and Larry Haskins had said that Miller had said that he had killed Patty with a tire iron. So they had this very incriminating evidence that came from these two people. But still, what they had said was is that Miller had said that he had buried her in a strip mine. And he'd also said to another investigator that he would never find the body. So investigators were stymied, even though they had all this circumstantial evidence, even though they knew that he was the likely suspect, that they couldn't do anything. And in that time, you write, this Miller's criminal resume was growing in leaps and bounds. First in 1967 with a burglary conviction, where he did got 2 years, and he did end up doing a year. And you say that his criminal record expanded and continued over those ensuing years, that this case was cold.
His record each year seemed to have gotten grew, and the crimes became much more serious as he got older. Well, the good point that you made was that police just did not have any evidence that a crime had occurred, that Patty was dead. The statements that Miller made to his friends were suggestive, and it involved a lot of drinking. And some of his friends thought, you know, it was just bragging, and because or that he was saying this to threaten them. But there was a feeling that, yes, he had something to do with her disappearance. But no one could prove it. And that was a big element of this crime. No one could prove that Patty was dead, because we're talking about the 1960s. We don't have surveillance cameras. We don't have cell phones. All of the things that we would use today to track someone who is missing just did not exist in the 1960s. And during the 1960s, a lot of teenagers went missing and were runaways and then would eventually return home, although that was not the case involving Patty. The stories that circulated, or should say the rumors that circulated of where Patty's body might be, one of them was that she was in the mines. It was another theory that she was buried under one of the highways that was under construction at the time. And of course, they wouldn't be able to dig up the highway for her body, especially since her body wasn't there, even if they had done that. So they were stymied. Everyone thought and were convinced in law enforcement that he had something to do with her disappearance and likely death, but no one could prove it. There was no body, and there was no clear and concise confession. His quote-unquote confessions were a little bit squishy, for lack of a better word. He would suggest that, except for one where he said he hit her with tire iron, the other people he would talk to say, well, they'll never find her. So there wasn't enough evidence without a body to tie him to the murder at that time.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second for these messages.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
You write that in 1970, he is convicted of raping a 13-year-old. He's given 15 years in prison, paroled in 5 years. Then in 1975, another rape, which is described as barbaric. He was sentenced to 10 to 20 years, He was released after 11 years. And this is 1987, I believe. And you introduce a central figure in this, a Corporal Danny McKnight, who had joined the Pennsylvania State Police when he was 21 years old. And he was the head of the criminal investigative unit. And in 1987, he got a very, very interesting phone call. Tell us about this phone call he received.
Yeah, Danny was in his office at the time. Danny, at that time, he was ahead of his times, ahead of his time in the law enforcement circles. In the 80s, a lot of law enforcement agencies, particularly those that were set up in some of the more rural areas, were not using, a lot of them weren't using computers. The internet was not a thing. A lot of databases that we now take for granted just did not exist. But he saw the importance of computerizing things and creating databases, and he would use that in investigations. So he always liked to think out of the box, so to speak. He always wanted to try something different when it came to investigations. But so he's sitting in his office. This is the type of investigator he is. But he's sitting in his office, and he gets a phone call is transferred to him, and it is a young woman. And the woman asks, gives him a specific date, and asks if a woman went, a teenager went missing on that date. And Danny said, "Well, I'll get back to you." And he checks around with some of the other investigators, particularly some of the old timers there, people with more time on the job. And one of the troopers comes up with the answer right away, saying Patty Desmond. He gets back to the woman who called, and it turns out that the woman who called was the daughter of the suspect, Conrad Miller. And he asks her some more information. And she, of course, was an infant when all of this happened. But she tells him where Patty's body likely was. She eventually tells him where Patty's body likely was and how she obtained the information. It was someone else in her family who told him that Conrad had confessed to her years earlier in the 1960s when the murder happened. So that gave them a very good idea of where to now move the case. However, this is the 1980s, so they have to go back in time and re-interview some of the earlier suspects, so the earlier witnesses, and also check the story that Conrad's daughter has told them. The location of where Patty's body might be, who owns a property, who owned the property. Would Conrad have known about this property? And it turns out, yes, he did, because it was a family-owned property. What they were told was that Conrad had killed Patty, had brought her body to an abandoned house and set the house on fire. The investigators, Danny McKnight and Glenn Hall, State Trooper Glenn Hall, then went to the volunteer fire department in that area to check their fire records and found that, yes, there was a fire at that house, but because it was abandoned, they just basically let it burn. And they checked the real estate records of the property and discovered, yes, the property was owned by one of Conrad Miller's relatives, so that the daughter's story did hold up on the as they checked the records. And then they went back and talked to her again, and then talked to the person that gave her the information. And as a result of that, and talking, re-interviewing earlier witnesses from the 1960s and 70s, they were able to get a search warrant for the property to do an archaeological dig to see if there were human remains in what was once an abandoned house.
Let's, Maureen, talk about, because we didn't go over this. This is a horrifying revelation that Connie, his daughter, was given. Conrad Miller's daughter gave up this information. But we didn't talk about, after 11 years, after his second rape, after all of these suspicions of murder, this daughter took him in to her home with her two children and her husband as part of the parole. And then her mother lived nearby and came and told her a horrifying story, which prompted her, the daughter, to finally come forward and crack this case.
Yes. And that was just very chilling to Connie. Connie opened up her home to her father. Connie is a very religious young woman, and she felt that everyone deserves a second chance. And after all, it was her father. He needed a place to stay. So she opened up her home to him. Her mother lived down the street, and her mother was not pleased that he was living there. And her mother then told her that he had confessed to her and told her details of what he had said to her and where Patty's body likely was, or where he told her Patty's body was.
There was details he gave her about that night and the ensuing days, but also when he first came back to the trailer and the mention of this gun that he had left the trailer with and what happened with that gun when he returned. So tell us a little bit about the details that he gave to Shirley, his wife, and then imparted later to the daughter about that evening in question.
But he had a bayonet, and the bayonet was eventually given to one of Connie's relatives, her father. She was not certain what that was used for. She said he did have a gun that night, but you know, in that area of Pennsylvania, in Western Pennsylvania, it's not unusual for people to have guns in their vehicles. So that was him having a gun would not have been a real major red flag to investigators. However, the fact that he had this bayonet, that you know, a sword-like bayonet, that they were very intrigued with and wanted to be able to recover that to see if there was any blood or anything like that on it.
You talk about the dig, the arrangements to make this dig, and the professional help was needed. So the investigators went to see the district attorney, David L. Cook, and he suggested people at the Pittsburgh School of Anthropology. And so you'd write that May 14th, 1987, McKnight and Hall spoke with Shirley and got all this information. And also, they also got an incredible amount of information about his personality and what the marriage consisted of. Basically, when his child was born, he was nowhere to be seen and didn't show up at the hospital. His marriage was characterized by him partying continually like a child and not paying attention. In fact, when she mentioned divorce, he said no. And they heard about a report of him being so angered that he tried to drive his wife and daughter off the road and possibly kill them, I imagine, because he was so angered. So she finally did get a divorce once he was in prison.
Yes, she did. And, you know, I suspect she didn't get a divorce much earlier because she was so young when she first got married that it took a while for her to get up the resolve to end the marriage. He was, you know, after the first child was born, he just continued to party. He was not the doting father. He was not described as the doting father. You were asking about the University of Pittsburgh. What they needed to do at that point was to prove that Patty's remains were at the site that they were told he brought her. They could not just take someone's word for it. So what they did was they got in touch with the Department of Archaeology, and a group of grad students had agreed to do an archaeological dig at the site of the house where they believed Patty's remains were. And this was really unusual at the time for the state police, particularly in that part of the state. What they did was a group of grad students headed by Dennis Dirkmet, who is really well-renowned in the field of archaeology, forensic archaeology. They did a modern-day archaeological dig at the site and painstakingly sifted through the dirt there to try to find remains. One of the problems that they faced right away was that after the original fire, the area was bulldozed over for safety reasons, clearly. So they had to get that first layer off and then keep going down further and further and further until they did find bones, fractured fragments of bones, of human remains in at the site. Not enough, you know, it was not like a full skeleton. And what they discovered later and what they suspected based on what they found was that the Patty's remains were set on fire in the house, and it was her killer appended the remains, or chopped up the remains as it was burning, which was just gruesome that someone would do that to such a young girl. So they were able to identify remains as a young woman, most likely teenager, female, based on the fragments of the remains that were found. They found fragments of every part of a body, but not a full skeleton.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second to hear from our sponsor. Ritual knows that it's impossible to get all the nutrients your body needs just from your diet. So Ritual has created a multivitamin that can supply your body with all the nutrients it needs. My wife Lisa and I started to take Ritual just based on the research they'd done to create their multivitamin. It's been a few years now for both of us, and we continue to rely on Ritual multivitamin every day. A clinically backed multivitamin for women 18 plus with high quality and traceable key ingredients in clean, bioavailable forms. With 9 key nutrients in 2 capsules per day, their unique bed Latin oil is even patented. Instead of striving for perfect health, aim for supporting foundational health. Great news. Ritual is offering my listeners 10% off during your first 3 months. Visit ritual.com/murder to start Ritual or add Essential for Women 18 plus to your subscription today. Now, you talked about that there were very, very small bone fragments, but as this started off, it was very encouraging because Dirkmat initially said that no matter what, there would still be some intact bones, that fire would not be able to destroy these bones completely. So they did a careful archaeological dig, again, you say, which was the first for this police department, probably many in the state at all, and they found between 30 and 40 parts, which we could identify as being part of a specific part of a body. And so they basically knew that this was the remains of Patty Desmond, and as such, they made arrangements to make the arrest of Conrad Eugene Miller, didn't they?
Yes, they did, because at this point, they had sufficient cause to get an arrest warrant, because number one, there had been earlier stories, so that pointed them into the right direction of him. But most importantly, they had the statements directing them to the specific location where the remains were found there. So they were able to get an arrest warrant. A judge signed it. And then a team of state troopers staked out the rooming house that he was staying in and waited for him to return and then arrested him.
You talk about July 1st, 1987. And right away, he has his first attorney is a guy named Gettleman. And right away, again, this is just a preliminary to see if there's enough evidence to hold him over. And despite his attorney giving a vigorous defense right from the onset of this preliminary, he was held without bond, correct?
Yes, that's true. And, you know, and that is not unusual in murder cases. Suspects, I have not seen a case yet where, at least cases that I've covered in the past, where anyone accused of murder is free on bail. I think there's only been one case where someone was allowed to be free on bail, but it's very, very rare. So it was not a surprise that he was held on bail or on no bail in the case.
This is a potential death penalty case. As you write, as of 1972, a Supreme Court in Pennsylvania, tell us what the status of the death penalty was and the likelihood of Miller being convicted with the death penalty.
Yeah, at that point in time, the death penalty was sort of in a foggy area. It had been overturned, been reinstated, and the courts needed to determine whether this actually qualified, number one, as a death penalty case, and number two, if the death penalty would have been in effect at the time of the killing. Were those cases overturned, it was ultimately decided that this was, not, number one, not a death penalty case. So that was taken off the table. And then they started to say, okay, what evidence was available and what were the chances of winning a conviction in this case?
The idea that he was very, very angry at his daughter and wrote a letter once he was arrested and said he would never forgive her. And she wrote back and said, you've got to confess and to what you have done. And so, and then you explain that there are three types of murder charges in Pennsylvania, first degree, second degree, and third degree. Sometimes that third degree would be called manslaughter in another state. Can you explain the sentences and the sort of the parameters of what would be considered first, second, and third degree murder?
What they had determined in this case is that this was not a first degree murder case under Pennsylvania law. We have to remember each state is very, very different when it comes to the different degrees of murder. So they had, there had been some discussions with the defense attorneys to figure out, okay, can we win here? Or can there be, can we win a conviction? Can we win an acquittal? And they had settled on a decided, no, let's, we're going to plead out the case so that there would not be a trial. What he pled guilty to is something called murder in the third degree, as opposed to, you know, first degree, second degree, or any other things. In with third degree murder, he was eligible for parole. He could wrap up his case in 14 years based on the sentence that he was given. So it became a matter of, did they want to roll the dice and risk getting a much serious, longer sentence of 20 years or go for 14 years? And that's what he did. He pled guilty to third degree murder and he was given a 14-year sentence. But that also made him eligible for parole a bit earlier. So he was parole eligible, but he would wrap up his sentence after 14 years.
Yes, he could be eligible for parole in 7 years out of the 14 in that plea agreement. And he also got away with being determined that there was no premeditation or intent to kill in not in the commission and not in the commission of a felony. And so he got off pretty easy in this plea agreement because, as we mentioned, he sat there again with the assistance of his mother. So talk about premeditation in terms of the disposal and the murder of Patty Desmond, maybe not the murder, but the post-murder activities, in that he sat there and stirred that fire to, in the belief that he could burn those bones into oblivion and not be arrested ever for this heinous crime. And so he got very lucky with that plea agreement. Usually it'd be 10 to 20 years in this third degree, and yet he was had the ability to get parole in 7 years. You write about the victim impact statements, even though, I mean, this is a plea agreement, but yet at the time there was the ability to write statements, even talk to a parole board and voice their opinions as to whether he should be released. But also at when he was on the stand for this plea agreement, their impact statements were important, especially for Miller's family. Can you explain?
The impact statements for give the victims and their families that chance to address the court, to let people know how this crime has affected them. And in some cases, it can help when it comes to sentencing. Obviously, in this case, the sentence was agreed upon as part of the plea. And one of the reasons why that the prosecutors did agree with this plea was there was the great unknown of what would Miller argue in terms of how Patty was killed. Was it an accident? Did he panic? Could they prove that it was premeditated? They clearly didn't have enough evidence in that regard, but they were able to, based on the evidence, clearly prove third degree murder. So as a result, that was why he pled guilty to that. When it comes to, I think Patty's mother gave a very impassioned statement to the court, and she was very upset that he got what she considered a very light sentence. You know, she spoke to how it affected her family, you know, that how he had taken something away from them and how unfair it was that, you know, he could go out on parole and, you know, the family still has to live with her death. And she was, she said that if he did it, if he's out on parole, she believed that he would do it again because he was out, got away with the killing of her daughter for so long. The murder had affected her entire family, that it had torn them apart. She had, you know, acknowledged that it may have also affected his family, but she didn't believe, or she didn't know if he even cared about how it affected his family. And that was it.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second to hear from these messages.
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Now, you talk about that in 1994, Assistant District Attorney David Hepting wrote the parole board to oppose Conrad Miller's release on parole. What did the parole board have to say with that recommendation?
He was denied parole. Miller wound up serving the full 14 years. He wrapped up his sentence. But he was not released on parole.
Now, you write about once he's released from prison, his only contact is with his namesake, which is Conrad Jr. And he gets in trouble, afoul of the law again after his 14-year sentence. And he write that he eventually cycles through the court and probation system yet again, yet to complete a drug and alcohol treatment program. He pled guilty to driving under the influence, possession of drug paraphernalia, and retail theft. He did another 18 to 36 month sentence. Again, he was charged in 2009, and he was directed to complete a sexual offender assessment and continue on probation. And there was always a restitution order of a little over $8,000. So you write that he would make payments of $25 a month and bring a big bag of change, including pennies, into the office to pay off this, but still didn't make any headway with this fine. And to show his personality, he fought every inch of the way, thinking that they were not entitled to fine him or to give this restitution order. So he fought that restitution order all the way and spent his time doing that, and never did pay the restitution order, but fell afoul of the law. He continued to do that. And yet you write that he still wound up with a girlfriend and some sort of life once he was released after spending almost entire life in prison.
Yes, he met a woman. It's my understanding he's now living with her. He moved out of the area and is, I assume, living a much calmer life. His girlfriend, I have been told, is very religious, so he may have found God. And, you know, and hopefully he has found some peace and is acknowledging some of his past crimes in his soul and his heart. But it does not take away the pain of the family and what they've gone through. And however his life continues or ends, it is still the family of the victim who still carries the scars of what he had done that night when 15-year-old Patty Desmond, you know, snuck out of the house and hopped in his car.
Now, back to the person that really, two people really cracked this case in terms of coming forward, that being Shirley and her daughter, Connie. But you talk about that when Shirley's mom died in 2011 and when their brother passed away in 2015, Conrad Miller went to the funerals and she said it was awkward. But when her father died in 2016, what was Miller told to do at that time by the family?
He was told to stay away, and he did.
You say that you write about 8 years ago that Miller contacted Shirley. What did he have to say to her at that time? What did he ask her for?
He did ask for her forgiveness. And it's a very difficult thing to ask for, you know, to get forgiveness, to forgive someone who had hurt you and it hurt so many other people for so long.
You briefly spoke to him. What did you ask him and what did he have to say to you?
He did not want to discuss what happened. He didn't want to talk about the case. He said, you know, what's past is past. And that he was very reluctant to say anything beyond that. You know, it was, I think he was trying to just put it all behind him because, again, this was not a really high profile case when Patty went missing. And even when he pled guilty, there was maybe a handful of stories about the case at that time. So I think he may be just hoping to just live out his life in obscurity right now.
You write near the end of this book that each year an estimated 600,000 people go missing in the U.S. The National Missing and Unidentified Persons System reports that 4,400 unidentified bodies are recovered yearly, with a shockingly 1,000 of the remains unidentified after 1 year. Before I let you go, tell us about the impetus for this book, the origins of this book, and how it all occurred.
I was working on my second book, The Ghost, The Murder of Police Chief Greg Adams and the Hunt for His Killer. And that was set in Saxonburg, Pennsylvania, and New Bedford and Dartmouth, Massachusetts. And while I was in the Saxonburg-Butler area, I was talking to Danny McKnight, who was a road trooper at the time that the Saxonburg chief was murdered. And he told me about this case and how unusual it was. And I was intrigued by it. I didn't start working on it right away. I did some more research and he had some additional information on the case. I found it intriguing, and that it was the impetus to this. It is part of the an offshoot of my second book. What's interesting also is when we think of horrific murders, very often people will think of large cities or communities right off of large cities. And both Saxonburg and the general area where Patty went missing and was later found dead, this was rural, and this was an area where people generally felt safe, where they would leave their doors open. And this is not what happens in their community. I think that is what was also very, very shocking to people at the time.
And like you say, this is not, even though it's 30 miles from Pittsburgh, this is a world away from a front page story in the newspapers in major cities at that time.
Yes. And, you know, when Patty went missing, there was a whole different attitude of missing teenagers. It was always assumed, in most cases, it was assumed that the child was a runaway. And, you know, unlike today where we've got, you know, Amber Alerts and social media alerts and postings about missing children almost daily, back then it was very, very different. So a child could go missing and other people, community over, would not know about it.
Yes. Extraordinary story. I want to thank you so much for coming on and talking about Last Child Seen, the search for Patty Desmond. Maureen Boyle, is there a website that people might take a look at? And do you do any social media?
Yes, I do. It would be MaureenBoyleWriter.com. And I'm on Twitter and Instagram. On Instagram, it is Maureen E. Boyle. You know, it's one of those things I always have to check. Twitter, it's Maureen E. Boyle number one. You can also find me on Facebook with just my name.
Thank you very much, Maureen Boyle. Last Child Seen, The Search for Patty Desmond. Thank you very much for this interview, and you have a great evening.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, and good night.
You're dedicated to building a bright financial future. Grow your investments with Millibank's high-yield savings account. Earn a highly competitive annual percentage yield with no fees or minimums. Getting started is simple, too. Download the app, link your account, and start growing your money. Welcome to a new way to save more for the things that matter most. Welcome to Millibank. Visit Millie.bank or download the Millie app today.